Hello and welcome back to our digital class on Physical Chemistry of Polymers 2. This is the 7th lesson unit, entitled and focusing on reptation. In our past lesson units, we have worked out a detailed understanding of the time and frequency dependent mechanical spectra of amorphous polymer samples. We have clarified to us that in the regime of extremely short times, respectively very low temperatures, the sample is in a glassy state with no dynamics, rendering it to be energy elastic with high values of the elastic moduli in the range of a gigapascal. Whereas on timescales longer than the shortest relaxation time tau zero, main chain dynamics is sequentially activated and the system shows coil internal relaxation modes of chain subsequences inside the coils. This manifests itself as a leather-like, viscoelastic solid-like regime that is phenomenologically on macroscopic levels described by the Kelvin-Voigt model, whereas the microscopic processes behind that are assessed within the concept of Rouse and Zim-type relaxation modes. The longest relaxation mode, with a characteristic time tau Rouse or tau Zim, denotes the end of that regime, and for samples composed of short chains, after that, free viscous flow sets in, marking the terminal flow regime, wherein which the macroscopic sample appearance is captured by the Maxwell model for viscoelastic fluids, whereas the microscopic processes are again by the Rouse and Zim theoretical framework for chain dynamics. Now in the sense that motion, that means displacement of the whole chain, that is, the whole coil, over distances at least equal to its own size, is present. For samples composed of longer chains, precisely so long that they can form mechanical entanglements with each other, by contrast, another regime sets in, which is marked by an intermediate frequency or time-independent plateau of the storage part of the modulus. This regime starts already before the Rouse or the Zim time, or its inverse on frequency scales, in a sense that its onset is marked by a different characteristic time, which we refer to as the entanglement time, tau e. This time corresponds to relaxation of relaxation modes of subchain segments as long as the entanglement strand length is. This length denotes the length of a polymer network strand between two entanglement points in the physical polymer network that we have present in a melt of long entangled chains. From this characteristic time on, even though the activation of yet higher relaxation modes corresponding to the coherent motion of even longer subchain segments is possible, and in fact activated, the mutual entanglement hinders the chains to effectively displace from each other. In that domain of times of frequencies, the sample behaves just as if it were permanently chemically cross-linked. In our last lesson unit, we have devoted a detailed discussion to that situation, clarifying to us how the height, the magnitude of the rubbery plateau can be conjectured with a microstructural picture of the network mesh array, in the sense that we have worked out formulas to connect the elastic modulus in the range of the rubbery plateau to the number concentration, respectively the molar mass of network chain segments in the network system. In such systems that are actually chemically cross-linked, this rubbery plateau persists forever, so to speak. It spans times of infinite length. Respectively, it proceeds down to infinitely small frequencies on a frequency axis. In systems that are just mechanically entangled, by contrast, the rubbery plateau has an end, after which eventually free flow sets in. This end is marked by the time it takes for the chains to get loose of their entanglements and to disentangle from each other, which does then eventually allow the coils to move as a whole, despite they are entangled with each other. And that situation is the last regime in the rheological spectrum for which we do not yet have a microscopic conceptual picture at hand. We already have a macroscopic phenomenological picture, which is that the flow behavior in that regime is captured by the Maxwell model for viscoelastic liquids. But what we don't yet have is a microscopic picture on how the chain motion, specifically the chain disentanglement, actually occurs in that regime. This will be on the agenda of this present lesson unit. And as its name already discloses, the theoretical framework that we will work out in this lesson unit is named reptation model. To derive that picture, yet again we find ourselves confronted to a challenge, which lies in the situation that our endeavor to conceptually and ideally also mathematically describe the long-term relaxation of an entangled multi-chain system is a complicated, if not complex, multi-body problem. The solution to this challenge for us will be to not even attempt to solve this problem concurrently for all the chains that move simultaneously through the sample volume and through the array of mutual obstacles constituted by their mutual entanglement points, but instead to focus on just one chain in the system, which we name test chain. We can imagine this as if there would be one chain in our sample that is somehow distinguishable from the others, for example, because it's labeled with a fluorescent dye or by radioactive marking, sitting in a background of chemically identical but unlabeled chains. This is illustrated to you in figure 93A. We focus our following consideration on only that labeled test chain. This focusing on just one test chain, which is the blue labeled chain in figure 93A, allows us to simplify our following consideration considerably by narrowing down our scope to only the very close environment of the test chain contour, as illustrated in figure 93B. At this point, a congenious approach by Samuel Edwards comes into play, which lies in modeling that direct entangled environment of our test chain to be like a solid tube in which the test chain finds itself entrapped, as it's shown in figure 93C. This conceptual picture traces back to the thought that the surrounding segments of other entangled chains largely constrain the motion of the chain in directions perpendicular to its own contour and limit it to curvilinear motion to creep along the own contour, just as if it were entrapped in a solid tube around it. By such curvilinear motion along the own contour, the chain can then creep out the constraining tube, as illustrated in figure 93D, progressing forward like a reptile, like a serpent in the woods. This is what the reptation mechanism is about. Mathematically, the construction of the tube goes such that we model each neighboring chain segment to impart a parabolic confining potential on the test chain. The energetically most favorable arrangement of the test chain would then be to place its segments on the minima of these parabolic potentials through space, and that energetically most favorable conformation path is named primitive path. The test chain segments can fluctuate around that primitive path positions through their activation by thermal energy KBT up to a detour distance at which the surrounding parabolic confining potential has a value of KBT. That is as far as the thermal activation with also KBT of the chains allows them to move. If they would try to move further, energies greater than KBT would be necessary, which is not present at thermal activation. This distance from the primitive path marks the diameter of the tube, and that diameter is it what constrains the motion of the chain in directions perpendicular to the primitive path, or in other words, to the chain contour. By contrast, as indicated already, the only way for the chain to move is by curvilinear reptile-like motion along the tube contour, which is the basis of the reptation model. This model has been introduced by the Frenchman Pierre-Gilles de Gennes, who received the Nobel Prize in Physics in the year 1991 for his discovery of striking universality of ordering phenomena encountered in various kinds of soft matter systems, that means systems composed of building blocks with colloidal scale sizes and interacting through weak interaction energies, like polymers that are a prime representative of soft matter, to classical, let's say normal matter, for example, magnetic materials. In a sort of hobby project, Pierre-Gilles de Gennes also worked on polymer dynamics and mathematized the reptation model in the following fashion. We know that the dynamics in polymer melts is best described by the Rouse model. This is because in this model, hydrodynamic interactions are ignored. They are taken into account in the alternative model, the ZIM approach, which is indeed a scenario encountered in melts because there, the strong extent of coil overlap, in fact, screens or shields these interactions, such as if they were not present. That means the diffusion coefficient of the chain along the tube can be modeled as introduced in the Rouse model framework, which we have discussed in the sixth lesson unit of part one of this lecture series, denoting as an equation that is repeated here in the form of equation 5.85. This equation is generally a derivative of the fundamental Einstein equation that describes the diffusion coefficient of a species as a ratio of the driving energy, KBT, and a dragging friction coefficient. And in the Rouse model, that friction coefficient for the whole coil can be written as n times a segmental friction coefficient for each and every single individual monomer segment. Because the modeling approach of the Rouse model is to model the coil, the chain, to be a sequence of beads connected by springs, whereby potential solvent freely drains through the coil, and so viscous friction is exerted by each and every single individual bead. The total chain friction coefficient, F chain, is n times F segment. And that is what enters the denominator of the Einstein equation, rendering it to equation 5.85. The tube diffusion coefficient is the driving energy, KBT, relative to the dragging friction, N times F segment. In addition to the fundamental Einstein equation, whereupon equation 5.85 relies, we know another very fundamental equation for the diffusion coefficient, which is the Einstein-Smoluchowski equation that connects the diffusion coefficient to the time-dependent mean square displacement that a randomly walking molecule or particle undergoes. It reads, mean square displacement is equal to 2 times d times d times t, whereby the first d, which is written as a non-capital letter, denotes the geometrical dimension, and the second d, that is written in capital letter, is the translational diffusion coefficient, and t is time. This equation tells us the mean square displacement of a randomly walking particle or molecule scales linear with time, and it does so to a greater extent if the mobility of the species is higher, as assessed by the diffusion coefficient, and if the random walk occurs in more dimensions, as reflected by the dimensionality non-capital D. And the factor of 2 emerges because in each dimension we have 2 possible directions. We can go into the plus or minus x, into the plus or minus y, and in the plus or minus z direction per step. When we adopt this equation for the reptating polymer, we can rearrange it for t and estimate this specific t at which the chain has completely left its constraining tube. We name this time the reptation time and denote it with the symbol tau rep. To appraise it, we have to do nothing else than replacing the mean square distance in the Einstein-Smoluchowski equation by the square of the contour length of the tube, because that's the distance the chain has to travel to leave the tube, which shall occur in the time tau rep. So according to equation 5.86, we write tau rep is equal to the contour length of the tube square over 2 times the diffusion coefficient. Here we have set the dimensionality factor 1, because the diffusion along the tube is a one-dimensional diffusion. Of course, the tube is a three-dimensional object, and so the motion actually occurs in 3 dimensions, but we are interested in the diffusion along the contour of the tube, which is in fact a one-dimensional movement around a curved trajectory that we could also, however, project into a one-dimensional axis. If we replace the diffusion coefficient in the denominator in that equation 5.86 by the expression given in equation 5.85, we obtain the rightmost hand form, which denotes us that the reptation time is proportional to the number of segments inside the chain, n with a power of 3. So we see that the degree of polymerization, and with that also the molar mass of our test chain, has a tremendous impact on the reptation time. It goes in with a power law exponent of 3, meaning if the chain degree of polymerization, respectively the chain molar mass, doubles, the reptation time will be 8 times as long. At an earlier point in our lecture, we've already seen that there is a very fundamental connection between the microscopic relaxation time of polymer chains and the macroscopic quantities shear modulus and viscosity, in a sense that viscosity is shear modulus times relaxation time. That was equation 5.64. We now adopt this equation to polymer melts. We first discuss non-entangled melts, so we step away from the reptation picture for a moment here. In this case, the relaxation time, whereupon which flow sets in, is the rouse time, tau rouse, for which we have derived an equation in the first part of our lecture series, as given in equation 5.87, that connects the rouse time to the shortest relaxation time in the system tau zero, that's the relaxation time of only single monomer units inside of a coil, with a chain degree of polymerization n with a power law exponent of 1 plus 2 nu. Polymers in the melt state display their ideal chain conformations. That is something we have also seen in part 1 of this lecture series. So for that, we have a Flory exponent of 1/2. Plugging that in for nu gives us the equation tau rouse is equal to tau 0 times n square. Furthermore, for chains in a non-entangled melt, we can generally estimate the shear modulus at the onset of flow to be of order of kBT per chain. That we have also discussed in detail 2 lesson units ago, where we have recapitulated again the concept of relaxation modes and made ourselves clear, again as we actually know it already from part 1 of this lecture series, that in the leather-like regime of coil internal relaxation modes, the modulus drops from a magnitude of kBT per monomer at the shortest relaxation time tau 0 to a value of kBT per chain at the longest relaxation time tau rouse, and at intermediate times it is P times kBT, whereby P denotes the mode index down to which relaxation of relaxation modes has already proceeded. We're considering the onset of flow now here, and at that point, the modulus is, as just said, kBT per chain. In equation 5.88, we denote the per chain part of this equation as the volume fraction over the volume of the chain material, N times L cube, which gives us the number of chains per volume in the sample. Taking together the latter 2 equations, equation 5.88 and equation 5.87, for the modulus and the longest relaxation time, we get an expression for the viscosity, as denoted in equation 5.89, which is modulus times relaxation time. The modulus has a scaling with a degree of polymerization according to n to the minus 1, as seen in equation 5.88, whereas, as we have made ourselves clear a minute ago, the relaxation time, tau rouse, has a scaling with n square. Together, this gives us a scaling of the viscosity with the number of segments in the chain n with a power of 1, a linear scaling. This picture is very different if we now consider entangled melts. Here, the relaxation domain sets in at the reptation time, which, as we have just seen, scales with n cubed, as we have worked out in equation 5.86 and as it's repeated again in equation 5.90. For the modulus at this point, we can say that at the end of the rubbery elastic plateau, and in general, in the rubbery elastic plateau, the modulus is independent of the chain length. It depends on the length of the entanglement strands of the subchain sections between two entanglement points that we have discussed in great detail in our last lesson unit. But it's independent of the total degree of polymerization or molar mass of the chain. What that quantity determines is how extended the rubbery elastic plateau is, meaning down to what frequencies or up to which times it persists. But this has no impact on the magnitude of the modulus. Recall, this we have seen in one of the last figures discussed in our last lesson unit, where three rheological spectra of chains with low molar mass, intermediate molar mass, and high molar mass has been shown, showing different extents of the rubbery elastic plateau, but coinciding values of the modulus in that plateau. That means we can say that the modulus at the reptation time is independent of the chain degree of polymerization. It scales with n with a power of 0, so to speak. Bringing both together, as done in equation 5.91, gives us the viscosity. Again, this calculates as modulus times relaxation time, and as the first has no scaling with n, whereas the second has a scaling with n cubed, the viscosity also has a scaling with n cubed. As a result, we see that the viscosity of a polymeric melt has two distinctly different scaling regimes as a function of the chain degree of polymerization or molar mass. This is shown to you in figure 94, which shows a log-log plot of viscosity over molar mass. Whereas at low molar masses, the scaling exponent is 1, but by contrast at high molar masses, it is 3. The bendover from the one to the other scenario occurs at a characteristic molar mass ME. That's the minimum molar mass that is necessary for chain entanglement. At this point, we think about our conceptual example with the Mensa spaghetti again. Mensa spaghetti are always short to prevent them from undergoing entanglements, which makes processing them hard in large containers like the Mensa kitchen. Only the spaghetti in a proper Italian restaurant are long and heavily entangled with each other, such that we can nicely play around with them with our fork when attempting to eat them. The characteristic value ME denoted in figure 94 is typically twice the entanglement molar mass we have encountered in our last lesson unit, which denotes the molar mass of a chain segment between two entanglement nodes. And that also, according to equation 5.76, translates to the magnitude of the elastic modulus in the intermediate rubbery plateau regime, which is about a gigapascal for many polymer melts. It's easy to understand here that the minimum molar mass for chain entanglement is about twice the entanglement strand length. To form an entanglement at all, the chain must be at least twice as long as the segment between two entanglement points will be in the end. Footnote to figure 94, actual experimental data actually suggests an even steeper scaling of viscosity as a function of molar mass in the entangled regime, which is experimentally found to be 3.4 rather than 3. The explanation for this is the concept of tube length fluctuations. Of course, the tube is not a solid object, but also a thermal object, so to speak. It's made out of chain segments that themselves fluctuate, and this fluctuation is most pronounced at the ends of the tube. That means the effective tube is actually shorter than the chain contour lengths. It has fuzzy ends, so to speak, and therefore allows for quicker relaxation of those segments at the extremities than for those in the center of the test chain. This facilitating mechanism, however, loses in significance when the chain gets longer, because then, relative to the chain contour length, the fuzzy ends of the tube are less impactful. That means, in addition to the strong additional hindrance imparted by longer chain length, also this facilitating mechanism loses significance more and more with increasing chain length. And this puts another contribution of 0.4 on top of the 3 in the scaling law exponent. In the limit of very long or very heavy chains, however, this full additional mechanism then loses significance, and eventually at very high molecular weights, respectively polymerization degrees of the chain, the reptation prediction of a power law exponent of 3 is recovered. In addition to the scaling discussion of the macroscopic quantity viscosity, let us also look upon a microscopic quantity, which is the translational diffusion coefficient that we have introduced already earlier in this lesson unit. So far, we have introduced it as a one-dimensional tube diffusion coefficient, which describes the quasi-one-dimensional diffusion of the chain along the tube contour. In addition, or on top of that, there is a second kind of diffusion coefficient that needs to be discussed, and this is the one for more global displacements of the chain, considering length scales much longer than the tube length. In this realm, the chain diffuses three-dimensionally through space. We can imagine this as if it would be a hopping process from one tube to the other, which occurs three-dimensionally. So this is a normal three-dimensional Fickian random walk diffusion characterized by a second kind of diffusion coefficient, which we denote d-rep. Again, we can mathematize d-rep in the framework of an Einstein-Smoluchowski equation as done in equation 5.92, which relies on the premise that the diffusion process is, as just indicated, imagined to be like a hopping process from one tube to the other, with steps displacing the coil three-dimensionally by exactly its own size in the time tau rep. Because in that time, the chain completely leaves the tube and has then displaced by its own size. This means we appraise the diffusion coefficient to be roughly r square over tau rep. We ignore the geometrical factor of 2 times d, where d is the geometrical dimension here, which would be 3. And so there would be a geometrical factor of 2 times 3, meaning 6 in there. But that we ignore here, because in the next step, we want to go to a scaling discussion anyways. We know that the denominator in that equation, tau rep, scales with n cubed. And we also know that the chain in the melt has ideal conformations. So the square of its size, the square of its end-to-end distance, can be written by the ideal chain scaling law n times L square. This means in total the three-dimensional Fickian reptation diffusion coefficient is expected to show a scaling with n with a power of minus 2. And indeed, that power law scaling has been found by numerous kinds of experiments, where the microscopic diffusion of chains in an array of chemically equal chains, but somehow labeled, has been monitored by techniques like fluorescence microscopy, light scattering, or pulsed field gradient NMR spectroscopy. We can even take a deeper look here and focus on the reptative diffusion of the chain in an even more fine-resolved fashion. For that purpose, we consider one monomer segment on a reptating chain that is somehow labeled to us, for example, again, by radioactive marking or fluorescent tagging. And we now follow the mean square displacement of that labeled chain segment over time. If we do so, we can discover 4 different regimes, as visualized in figure 95b. We find a regime where the mean square displacement scales as a function of time with a power law with an exponent 1/2. Then another regime where it scales with a power law with an exponent of 1/4. Yet another regime where it scales again with a power law exponent of 1/2. And a final regime where it scales linear. See, what we see here are 3 different domains of subdiffusivity, where the mean square displacement is not linear in time, but less than linear, with a power law exponent of less than 1. We have discussed this already in our lesson unit on practice and theory of rheology, in view of the method of passive microrheology, where we monitor the time-dependent mean square displacement of tracer particles in a viscoelastic medium and take that observation as a basis to draw conclusions on the degree of viscoelasticity, so to speak, which, as we have seen in that lesson unit, also has to do with the extent of non-linearity, of subdiffusivity, of the time-dependent mean square displacement of the tracer particle diffusion. Maybe the best analogy to remember what subdiffusion is the example with a randomly walking wine lover on a wine fest in Mainz, who conducts a random walk-type step sequence when attempting to escape the wine fest and go home. And this sequence of steps, which, by the way, has a high likelihood to end up with an overall displacement of 0, because physics has an affinity to have us stay on the wine fest, is further impaired if wine stands are still open, because these act as traps on the way of our random walking friend, and thereby attenuate the mean square displacement to be non-linear in time, subdiffusive. How can we understand the complex pattern of subdiffusive regimes in figure 95b? For that, we have to just bring together what we have learned so far in this lecture. In the very first domain, we consider times between the shortest relaxation time possible, tau zero, and the entanglement time. In the viscoelastic relaxation spectra, we are in the leather-like regime in that domain. What happens here is that relaxation of chain subsegments is possible, including the subsection whereupon our labeled segment sits. And we know already from part 1 of this lecture series that the diffusion of a chain section inside the coil is subdiffusive, scaling with an exponent of 1/2 in the framework of the Rouse model, because the mutual connectivity of the chain segments hinder each segment to diffuse freely. The memory hook for that was, if this segment wants to go to northeast, but its 2 neighbors want to go to southwest, it has a hard time doing so. So the segments impart mutual hindrance on their diffusion, and that renders the time-dependent mean square displacement of each segment subdiffusive, with a power law exponent of 1/2 in the framework of the Rouse model. In the second domain, on timescales beyond the entanglement time, but not yet longer as the Rouse time, on top of this constraint comes another constraint, which is the constraint imparted by the surrounding tube. On timescales Beyond the entanglement time, we are in the rubbery plateau in the mechanical spectra. This is the time where the chain segments have relaxed as far as the tube diameter and are now aware of the entrapment inside of a tube. In this domain, as we have just worked out in this lesson unit, the chain can only partially move along the tube contour, which, however, as the tube is a three-dimensional object that in turn has a random walk type shape of a coil trajectory, displaces it in space only by the square root fraction of what it is displaced along the tube contour, because the tube itself is a random walk, and its mean square end-to-end distance scales with its length with a power of 1/2. So we have the first power law exponent of 1/2 that comes into play because the chain motion is hindered by mutual connectivity to neighbors, and on top of that comes a second exponent of 1/2, which comes into play due to the entrapment of the chain segment in a constraining tube that itself has a random walk type shape. This gives in total a 1/2 times 1/2, meaning 1/4 scaling law exponent. On timescales longer than the Rouse time, which opens the third domain in figure 95b, the first constraint is then lost. From that time on, the coil as a whole can displace, as we are beyond the Rouse time. We are, however, not yet beyond the reptation time, meaning we're still in the rubber elastic plateau, which microscopically means we still discuss chain motion along the tube contour, but not yet movement out of the tube, such that any displacement along that tube contour translates to just the square root of that in three-dimensional space, as the tube contour is a random walk in three dimensions, with a scaling of its end-to-end distance being proportional to the square root, meaning power of 1/2, of its contour length. This gives us again a power law exponent of 1/2, which is now not traced back to mutual hindrance due to mutual connectivity, as was the case in our first time domain in figure 95b, but now due to the hindrance imparted by the entrapment inside of a tube that has a random walk scaling shape. Only at very long times, below the reptation time, does our chain eventually diffuse freely through space, and with it, it does our labeled segment that we trace here, and display linear proportionality between the mean square displacement and time. That means normal Fickian diffusion. This whole discussion seems a little artificial. It seems to be something for scaling exponent lovers, but not of any practical relevance. There is, however, a great relevance in here, namely that experiments have indeed denoted this rather complex pattern of time dependencies of the mean square displacement, which is hard to explain by theoretical pictures, as it's so diverse and faceted. Our understanding of Rouse type and reptation type motion of chain segments in a melt on short and long timescales, however, is capable of explaining all the four sections in this dataset. And this is a strong evidence that we're not too bad with this modeling. There is one last point that I'd like to discuss here, which is referred to as constraint release mechanism. So far in our reptation picture, we have considered the surrounding of our test chain to be a solid tube, composed of the surrounding neighboring segments of close-by chains. These close-by chains, however, can also be viewed as test chains in their respective own environment. This means they are actually mobile themselves. And that means the tube in which our first test chain is sitting is not so much of a solid object. This is also a living object, so to speak. And that means diffusion of our test chain is not only possible by the reptation mechanism that we have discussed all the time, but also by the reptation of the surrounding chain segments that can lead to disappearance of tube sections, which always happens if a surrounding chain segment that makes a tube wall element here distracts, as it's sketched in figure 96 of our script. How relevant this mechanism is dependent on how long-living the tube is. And that is dependent on how long the molar mass of the chains is that form the tube. In the situation of a polymer melt, the chains that form the tube are of same kind than the test chain that lies in it, as this is all the same polymer. This means the lifetime of the tube is comparable to the reptation time of the test chain. So indeed, both mechanisms contribute to the diffusive relaxation of the test chain. The situation is different if we think about the entrapment of a test chain in a matrix of longer chains. Then the tube definitely is longer living than the time it takes for the chain to leave it by reptation. And vice versa, if we have a long test chain embedded in a matrix of shorter chains, then the diffusive motion of the chain is predominantly fueled by the disappearance of the tube rather than the motion of the chain itself. With that, we're at the end of this lesson unit. We have now completed our conceptual picture of the microscopic phenomena behind the different sections in the time or frequency-dependent viscoelastic spectrum of amorphous polymers. We now know in much detail what the microscopic situation is in the glassy regime, in the leather-like regime, in the rubbery plateau regime, and in the terminal flow regime. Again, remember here that one and the same polymer displays all these diverse and very different mechanical characteristics, just depending on the timescale of observation and the temperature at which we do so. Because eventually, all the relaxation processes in the different domains are thermally activated, meaning they occur at higher rates if the temperature is higher, and vice versa. With that, we have reached the overall goal of this lecture series, namely to connect macroscopic phenomenological behavior to a microscopic structural and dynamic picture. That very high goal we have achieved now. We can now connect the microscopic structural and dynamic characteristics of a polymer sample in specific states, meaning at specific combinations of the variables time and temperature, to their macroscopic appearance. In view of the microscopic variables, so far most of the parameters we have introduced are the number of segments, the length of a segment, and the elementary microscopic time it takes for segments to displace. That, of course, is further translatable to chemical characteristics. The length of a segment, and also the number of segments in a subsection, which, footnote here, is commonly meant to be a Kuhn segment, is further translatable to the chemical specificity of a given polymer at hand, in which we calculate the number of Kuhn segments, for example, by the number of actual segments divided by the characteristic ratio, which is a primary chemical parameter reflecting how hard it is to rotate single monomer units against each other. And that has to do with the local chemical substitution pattern and with a kind of bond in the monomer unit. Similarly, the microscopic timescale tau, which eventually traces down to the shortest relaxation time tau zero, has to do with the chemical specificity, has to do with what kind of monomer we have at hand, by what kinds of bonds is it connected to its neighbors, and what energies of activation are necessary to displace it against its neighbors. With that, we have erected a great arc between the primary chain backbone chemistry, secondary chain conformations, and macroscopic sample properties as a function of the most relevant experimental state variables, thereby finishing our initially intended bridge between structure and properties of polymers. With properties in this respect, we primarily refer to mechanical properties, because those are the properties in which polymers are most rich, versatile, and useful, and for which they have shaped our materials world remarkably and made all our lives a lot more comfortable. Along the way of the discussion in our lecture, we also came across a class of methods to characterize mechanical properties of polymers, which is the method of rheology. To really complete the picture, though, what is still lacking is a sister class of methodologies to also probe structures of polymer systems. Most typically in material science, the prime method of probing structures is microscopic techniques, in which structures are made visible. This, however, is not so well applicable to soft matter systems, as their soft and amorphous appearance excludes them from imaging with high-resolution techniques such as transmission electron microscopy or atomic force microscopy. Footnote, the latter technique is nevertheless very relevant for polymers, but more as an analytical tool rather than an imaging technique. The prime experimental methodology to probe polymer system structures, therefore, is a different one. It is scattering techniques, which shall be on the focus of our following two last lesson units.